Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for coming. Welcome to the session on Getting to the Truth, the Role of Verification in Crisis Reporting. We've got a great panel for you here today, and there's an absolutely enormous pile of stuff to get through. Just wanted to say a quick word about who I am and a quick intro, and then we'll get straight into it. My name's Sue Llewellyn. I'm a former BBC journalist turned social media consultant and trainer. I've spent the last 8 years basically helping news organisations and journalists to find eyewitness media and to verify it. So this is right up my street. But it's always changing. Every time there's any kind of breaking news, particularly a crisis, there's as much false news or more than there is the real stuff. So it's cutting through the noise and getting to the news and the really serious stuff. So I've got a fantastic panel here today. There's some of the best experts around. We're going to start off by getting everybody to do a quick, perhaps 10-minute presentation with a case study. We're sort of largely starting off with the Brussels attacks to focus our attention, and then we'll sort of broaden that out to some of the wider issues. There will be time for questions at the end, because I will be quite a hard taskmaster time-wise, and I'm sure that you've got questions, so please do feel free to stick your hand up at the end. We'll get everybody talking first. So from left to right, and we'll start in that order, we've got Hazel Baker, who's the digital news editor at Sky News. We also have Eliza McIntosh, who's a journalist at the social media news agency Storyful. And we have Alistair Reid, who's the managing editor of First Draft News. And they'll all explain a bit more about what they do. But if I could hand over first to Hazel to take it on from here, and we'll get started.
Hi, as Sue said, I'm digital news editor at Sky News, and I lead Sky News' effort to source and verify eyewitness media for all stories, be they domestic or foreign. I'm going to start with an example of why I think that verification in a crisis is just so important. I'm going to play you a short video. This is something that we published for Sky News Mobile, which is why it's in square format with subtitles, and it was published at lunchtime on March the 22nd of this year. I'd like to note what percentage of this content is UGC or eyewitness media and not professionally shot content. And that's despite the fact we actually had a reporter and a small team in the airport at the time the blasts happened. So as you've seen there, 50% of that short video that we made at that lunchtime was actually user-generated content or eyewitness media. So clearly at Sky News, we think this material is really important, as long as it's verified. Now, what do our audiences think? Oh, sorry. Onto the next slide. There's actually some research that's been done about this by Claire Wardle, Pete Brown and Sam Doubley a couple of years ago, and they found some key points. In some cases, audiences may actually prefer to see eyewitness media over professional content, reporting a heightened level of intimacy and authenticity. So we spend lots of time in the newsroom thinking about how we send on big stories. We shouldn't forget that actually there are occasions where the audience really want to be there, being eyewitnesses to what's happened. However, the study also showed that audiences have got minimal appetite for unverified content. So what they really don't want to see is content that hasn't been checked by newsrooms and verified to the extent that we are sure that we know what we're looking at. From this, we can determine that authentic eyewitness media carries a really high value. Therefore, how do we structure the newsroom in a crisis to make sure that we're well equipped to both source and verify this content? One thing we've noticed through recent events, be they terror attacks, natural disasters, is that the early hours, in fact, the early minutes are critical. The social media sphere gets extremely noisy very, very quickly, and those filtering out the noise is much easier early on. So it may be a case of thinking about how the newsroom approaches its staffing level. There's certainly an argument for putting lots of people on the verification duties very early on, with a view to maybe moving people around later once we found some good content. We need to think about who's on these desks and how will they divide the workload? How will they make sure they don't duplicate? It's very easy to find lots of people from a newsroom contacting the same source, and that's not desirable from a duplication point of view or for the sake of the eyewitness. It's really important to get the tools right for verification as well. It's easy to forget that you need screen space if you're going to run multiple searches, and multiple searching is something that's key to the sourcing of UGC or eyewitness media. We also sometimes need plugins for translation and multiple platform search. Storyful's got a great example of that. And for reverse image checks. Having these things ready to go in a crisis is hugely important. There's no time to be downloading Flash plugins when you need to be searching straight away. And finally, probably most importantly, if we find and verify eyewitness media, how do we tell everybody in the newsroom what we found and what it shows? Having a system to communicate the content that we found and to add tags and credits as necessary is crucial to the process, and it's also crucial for sharing information about misattributed or hoax content. I've put together here what I think is a skills checklist for anyone who's working in verification. I'm working on the basis here that we're working with social media and looking at eyewitness media or UGC. So familiarity with social networks. It may seem obvious, but actually, the more you work with this material, you start to get an understanding of how different audiences are using social media and which platforms they may turn to in times of a crisis. Also crucial is knowing how to get in touch with people. It's really important for the verification process to ask questions of the people who've posted the content. So knowing what your options are for getting in touch with someone on Twitter or on Facebook or Snapchat is really key. If someone is working in verification, they need to be fluent in search processes using lists or geolocation tools, search operators like and or keywords, and also eyewitness language. We found a lot of people use things like me and I and we when they're posting about events that they've actually witnessed themselves. And they're the people we really want to speak to because they're at the front line and they often have questions, they often have answers that we need to ask about. And in the bottom right-hand corner, I've put awareness of copyright law and ethical issues. Copyright law is obviously crucial because if someone posts content on a social network, they own the copyright, not the social network. So we need to, at Sky News, make sure we've approached people who've posted this content to ensure they're happy for us to use it. That can be difficult in a crisis. You don't often get a response, but it's really important to make sure we do go through the process of trying to make an approach. And how we do so is something that's very sensitive. And ethical issues, which again Alistair will touch on later, there's certainly some instances of eyewitnesses who've really, really seen something horribly traumatic being approached by multiple news agencies, and it's up to us to make sure we act responsibly to not put further pressure or unreasonable demands on this person. Moving up, I've put ability to spot scrapes and locate original source. This is where classic journalistic tools come into play, finding the original source material. As soon as something's posted on a social network, it will often be shared or duplicated, and it's very difficult to track who the original owner is. If you're working in verification, it's crucial to be able to do this and to get a sense of, when you're looking at content, whether it's likely to have been filmed by the person who's posted it on their account. And finally, in the top right-hand corner, probably the crux of the whole process of verification, someone working in verification in a crisis needs to have had experience of systematic verification of both source and content. Fergus Bell has done a brilliant verification flowchart which looks at this two-tier system in depth. But it's essentially looking at the source of the content, trying to establish what the digital footprint is, trying to speak to them if possible and ask some more questions and work out whether it's probable that they were in the location of the incident at the time. Meanwhile, you have to approach the content with the same degree of analysis. Does it corroborate with other reports that you've seen? Does it tally with official versions of events? And are there any clues in the pictures that help you determine where it is that the event is happening? I'm going to finish with how we looked at the Brussels attacks in the Sky News newsroom. This was a very strange story for us because we actually had a small team in the Brussels airport at the time of the explosions. They were fortunately not close enough to suffer any harm, but they obviously felt and heard the shockwaves. So they called into our foreign desk very early on, and that early tip-off was what led us to search for corresponding eyewitness media very quickly. Early tip-offs are absolutely invaluable because at this point there was very little noise. Only the people who'd actually witnessed something were posting on social media. There was very little awareness that this had happened. And at that point, we could also compare the content that had been posted on social networks with the reports that our own team in the airport were giving us. So double explosions, people being led out, some smoke, ceiling tiles coming down. These were all consistent with what we were being told from our reporter, correspondent Alex Rossi, who was there, and also the people that he'd spoken to at the scene. Therefore, we brought up lots of corroborating images and video. We attempted to make contact with everybody who posted this content. We spoke to people on the phone and did phone interviews, and that was a great opportunity for us to ask further questions about what had happened, which again helps with the verification process. Finally, once we'd got hold of some material which we're happy was authentic, we shared it with the newsroom and sent out alerts to the whole newsroom saying what it was that it showed, where on the server we could find it, and also with what credit we should put on it. Not all pieces of eyewitness media are credited during a crisis because we are sometimes concerned that identifying the individuals involved may put them at further harm, particularly if it's an ongoing story, which obviously the Brussels attacks were. Possibly more importantly, we also put out an alert to any hoax content that was about. And in this case, the CCTV from that turned out to be from Moscow was quickly identified as a hoax, and the whole newsroom was told. It's really important that not only correct information is shared, but also misinformation is widely communicated to the newsroom to avoid this stuff being used in error. And that concludes my summary of Sky News' newsroom process for verification.
Thank you very much. While Eliza sets up, I'll just pick up on one or two of the points. That's obviously how it works in the Sky newsroom, and internal comms is a huge thing. How do you deal with the pressure, which must be coming from the output editors, to get something there first?
Yeah, the pressure is sometimes very, very evident, and they're only doing their job, which is to make sure they're telling the story in the fullest way that they can, and that's why they're putting the pressure on. But I think an important part of certainly my role and others in the newsroom is to be resilient against that pressure, point out it's far better to have authentic material with some background context to it than using material which we're not quite sure about, or even if it looks legit, we don't know the full story, and explain that there's a much greater value in using that verified UGC.
I suppose it's very important to be clear about what you know and what you don't know.
Yeah, of course.
And with that, we'll hand over to Eliza from Storyful.
So for those of you that don't know or aren't familiar with Storyful, we are the world's first social media news agency, and we help some of the world's biggest news agencies, news media, source and verify social content around breaking news stories of the day and longer feature work as well. But I wanted to take you through a few case studies that look specifically at the importance of verification and breaking news through the lens of the Brussels attacks. For those of you that were covering the attacks, you will know that there was a lot of misinformation that came out on the day, and this extended into social media as well, particularly in the content that we were seeing shared. But I'm going to take you through a couple examples about misattributed and misleading videos in particular. The first misleading videos that we saw in connection with the Brussels attacks were CCTV footage purporting to show the attacks at the moment of the explosion. Now, these videos ended up fooling a lot of the internet and some news outlets, proving once again the importance of verification, particularly in social journalism. And this is a screenshot of one of those videos. You'll see that Press TV used it in their own reporting. So this was less than an hour after the attacks took place at Brussels Airport. We saw this CCTV video of a 2011 attack on Moscow's Domodedovo airport rapidly spreading across social media. But it wasn't described in that way. Of course, it was described as showing the moment of the blasts at Brussels airport. So it was shared by a number of different Twitter accounts, many of them unverified accounts, but actually on the day there were a number of sources that I would consider to be, quite trustworthy sharing these accounts. And I tried to create this presentation this past week, and a lot of them had actually been deleted. And this is something I'm going to come back and touch upon later in the presentation. So these started to be tweeted around 8:18, 8:30, about an hour after the attacks occurred. And immediately what we did was go to YouTube and start doing keyword searches to see what we could pull up with similar language around the videos being used. And it was really as easy as searching CCTV airport attack, and within the first page of results on YouTube, we were able to see a video that tallied very closely with the video we were seeing. And that video was from 2011, and it showed that attack in Moscow. But we took it a step further as well, and we searched through news reports at the time, and we quickly found that in an article in the BBC, they also used this same video embedded in their coverage. So it just shows you in about a minute, we were able to debunk that CCTV footage that many people were sharing. So we run an account, it's a closed Twitter account for our clients, it's called Storyful Pro. And we approach it in the same way that you would think of AP, but we look at it as a very transparent way for us to report to our clients what we see happening on social, and we are lucky in that we can say what we know and what we don't know. So in this case, at 7:20, we alerted our clients to our Twitter list for Belgium for more information on the attacks, and we followed up within minutes of seeing the CCTV footage to say this video being widely circulated, don't use it in your coverage. And a number of clients had actually come to us just moments before this tweet asking us, that we're about to run this video, is this okay to use? And we were able to tell them to hold off and actually know not to use it. I just wanted to touch again, I mentioned when I went to make this presentation, a number of tweets that had shared that initial video were actually deleted. But what I think is really important in stemming the flow of misinformation in these breaking news events is to just really be honest about when you get things wrong. And so I was impressed by this tweet from VRT, which is a Flemish news agency, and this is them linking to a prior tweet that had linked to that video saying, this isn't from Brussels. I think that is crucial in terms of the verification work that we're looking at to stop that stem of misinformation. So very quickly, if one CCTV video wasn't enough, another one surfaced in relation to the attack at Malbik metro station. Again, this was from 2011. It was from a metro attack in Minsk. Very quickly, we were able to establish that it was also old, doing a lot of the same things, just Googling keywords and trying to see other CCTV video from attacks in metro stations. We were able to then find other videos of the same scene and then tally those videos with images of reports at the time. And this is really the type of fact-checking anyone would do, I think, in their own reporting. But I think in the scope of social journalism and social reporting, some of this can get lost. I think it's really important to be very critical of the content that you're seeing in real time. So while misleading videos were spreading like wildfire at this time, misattributed videos did as well. And I think that this is an interesting jump-off point to the importance of getting in touch with eyewitnesses. And I'll get into two specific examples. So Hazel showed this video, and I'm sure many of you will have seen it, so I won't play it here. But it gives a very dramatic picture of the moments directly after the attacks took place. It was filmed by a garage nearby. And this video was shared widely on social media within minutes of the attacks having taken place. One of the first versions of that video was shared by Anna Arenheim, who is a defense correspondent for I-24 News in Israel. And as you can see here, her video at this stage was retweeted over 26,000 times. And I'm familiar with Anna's work because I do a lot of reporting in the Middle East, but many people weren't. But the initial question I had was, what's she doing in Brussels? And I think that this is really key in looking at social content, is where is it coming from? Is that person really there? So a lot of people reporting on the attack did characterize her eyewitness video as, you know, a first-person account. So NBC incorporated it into a story saying, here's how the story is unfolding according to the people at the scene. CNN ran her video on breaking news on live air with a credit to her having been in Brussels. And I think the question that arises in a situation like this is it too good to check? Is the video too strong to check? Do we just want to run it because, you know, it's that good? And I think the answer is obviously no. It gives you so much more value in knowing who the person is that took that video, because then you get their eyewitness account, you learn more about the scene, and it's very important in protecting the source as well. So these are just responses to Anna's tweet within minutes after her having shared it. And in many cases, media outlets didn't bother asking if she was in Brussels or if the video was hers, but just simply asked, can we use it? We had reached out to Anna within a few minutes of having seen it and asked her if she was there, and she said she wasn't. And that she had found the video in a WhatsApp group, which is what we expected, because generally the way we see her sharing content and others in the Middle Eastern region is sharing it from WhatsApp groups. So hours later, she tweeted, FYI, this isn't my video, don't use it, from me. But within minutes of seeing her video, we were able to establish, okay, this isn't hers. It was shared in a WhatsApp group. We knew that it was a Hebrew language WhatsApp group, and we were able to then dive deeper to try and find the original source of that video. But as Hazel mentions, it's so important to do this very early on, because you get further and further away from the source as the video continues to get shared. So we were ultimately able to track the original source down. His name was Pinchas Kupferstein, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly for his benefit. He was credited by a number of different news outlets with misspellings of his name. Other people said his name was Tinchus Kupferstein, or you know, there were a number of different ways that people had misattributed the video, whether it was from a different person or a misspelling. But I think that the context is so important. And this work isn't always fast. This took us about a day to track him down. We were able to license the video and help him to maintain ownership of it and to be able to track the distribution of the video as well. So another video that was shared widely was taken inside of the airport. And it was another case where it took us quite a few hours to establish the original source. This video was a case where multiple sources were claiming ownership. And so it was coming down to like minutes, within minutes or seconds of the video having been posted on social, that we had to track it down to. One of the first shares that we saw was from a reporter who was based in Brussels with VRT. And we could tell that he was at the scene because he was sharing a number of other videos. He was taking videos of himself as well. But this video was very different to the others he was sharing. It was in a lower resolution, a different quality. It was filmed vertically instead of horizontally. So we reached out to him and asked him, you know, did you film this video? May we use it? Can you give us more context? And his answer was yes, that he had filmed it. Well, ultimately, we dug a bit deeper. We got in touch with another source who said that his uncle had actually taken the video, and we found Aris Saha, who was there and actually also worked for VRT. And we found that his share of the Facebook video was just a minute earlier than the other source. So we got back in touch with that reporter and said, you know, we've been in touch with Aris. He said that he's there. Can you give us some more information about this? And he said, oh yeah, you're right. It is his footage. You can credit him. So this just gives you a sense of, like, I'm sure many of you will know this already, but this can just be incredibly messy. But at Storyful, we think it's really important to protect the eyewitness and to make sure that their story is preserved and gets out there in the most appropriate way, and that they're credited appropriately. So that that might give you some food for thought in terms of your own breaking news coverage.
Thanks very much. While Alistair sets up, I think you're going to pick up on some of the points of protecting the eyewitness and some of the other, as I said, the sort of copyright and ethical issues, and there are many. It seems that people just aren't curious. The journalists just aren't curious. They're not asking the right questions.
I think that journalists are naturally curious, but I think, and I was saying this before with Hazel, I think we're in a really unique position at Storyful, in that we're a closed platform with a group of subscribers, and we can be really honest with them. This is what we know, this is what we don't know, we're looking for a source on this, this may be the source, but we haven't confirmed it. We're not as opened up to this sense of we have to be first. I mean, we do want to be first, but we also need to get it right. And I think that's the case for everyone, but we don't have that sort of sense of our competitors are running this footage already and we have to as well.
Okay. I know Alistair's keen to get started, so I'll hand over to you.
Thanks, Sue, and hello, everybody. My name's Alistair Reed. I'm managing editor at First Draft. Just by way of a very brief introduction, because we're quite a new organisation, having only launched the website in November, but we're a coalition of 9 organisations who all have a varying focus of expertise in exactly this area of where social media and journalism meet. So whether that is on skills and tools for verification, skills and techniques for social discovery and finding this kind of thing, or about the ethics. The kind of areas that we really focus on are, as I said, social news gathering, verification, ethics and law, fakes and hoaxes, and case studies. So it's hopefully trying to raise the conversation around this area, and you can find out more on the website if you so wish. We talked a lot about the ways that organizations find and verify newsworthy material during breaking news on social media, but there are a lot of issues around that at the moment, which as an industry we haven't really figured out because it's such a new area. One of them is, I put that harassment, obviously in inverted commas, because from the journalist's perspective, we are reaching out, trying to secure either use of some material or to verify it. But from what we're going to look at in a minute is from the other perspective, how that actually appears to many eyewitnesses and to many other members of the public, which, in short words, is not good. Some of the things we'll touch on are putting eyewitnesses in danger or protecting them and understanding the risks and responsibilities journalists have. Appropriate crediting, as both all of these things are things that Hazel and Eliza have touched on, but we'll go into it in more detail. And working with graphic imagery, which is something when there is the scene of almost every breaking news event, someone with a smartphone and a social media account, as it happens, not in the minutes after when the professional photographer or videographer would turn up in the past. There's a lot more graphic imagery coming into newsrooms. But on 22nd of March, at Brussels Airport, was a guy called David Crennel, who's an artist, who was at the airport. About 7:59, a bomb exploded about 20 metres away to his left. A couple of minutes later, seconds later, the second bomb went off. And in those first few minutes, he opened his phone and started filming, as is the norm now in many of these situations, as he staggered out of the airport, texted his family, and then sent this tweet. Two explosions at Brussels Airport. He proceeded to go on to, am I going to be able to get this to play, to document his what's happening at the airport, as you can see. And within 20 minutes, 8:20, his phone was ringing. He was getting endless phone calls. By 8:45, his phone was ringing just nonstop. By 10 o'clock, he says that he had received over 10,000 notifications on his phone in terms of people retweeting, people getting in touch, whether that's journalists, whether that's anyone, about the kind of information that he was sharing. And 7 hours later, at the end of the day, he was still getting phone calls. His phone was still ringing. This is now, this is the norm now for when, as we've been discussing already, breaking news happens, that people will document it, but that journalists need to figure out what's going on in that situation to tell their readers. But it becomes completely unmanageable for the eyewitness there in the kind of the way that it's happening at the moment. And what I'm not trying to say here is, like, don't contact eyewitnesses. No one is going to do that. No one is going to stop, because that's not getting to the story. But there needs to be a conversation and thinking how to do this in a way which doesn't mean that people like David and many others end up getting thousands of notifications, having their phone ringing all day when they're trying to process going through something like being at the scene of a bombing, stuff that they may have seen, and the general trauma of him being in that kind of situation. There was a much more serious case back in October at the Umpqua Community College in Oregon, where Chris Harper Mercer walks into his school and started shooting people. One student who was there at the time tweeted in a similar kind of reaction, as many people do when they see something now, to share it and tell people what's going on. Oh my God, there's someone shooting on campus. Students are running everywhere. Holy God. But unlike Cornell, she didn't respond to any of the kind of requests that she was getting, which went on and on and on, not just from journalists here, but from many people getting in touch. Eliza and Hazel are very skilled and experienced, as are their colleagues, in how to approach eyewitnesses in a sensitive and thoughtful way. These are some of the ones, just a selection, just a screenshot, that happened on that day, which was, can you call me? I am with X, follow me back. Hi, the name, I'm an editor with X News. We hope you're safe. Oh my God, there's someone shooting on campus. Hope you're safe. Can we contact you to find out more about what's happening? Another, please be safe. Could you call me? I'm an editor. I wanted to get your story out. Goes on and on. The last one, hi, contacting you from X. Are you actually at UCC? Hope all is well. I think we can probably guess that all is not well. This went on and on and on for hours. And there she got, you know, dozens, scores of journalists getting in touch with her to try and use their, to say what's going on and get more information on the story. This is all done in a very, very public way. And as you can see, the general public were not very happy about many of these approaches. Calling, this is just one, again, one example out of the scores of requests that she got. Scum, you're a vulture, you're garbage, you should be fired for this, we'll be contacting your employer, go to hell. Every one of these people who is commenting, and everyone who sees that kind of approach and thinks it's bad, is a potential member of the audience for that news organisation. And there is, at the moment, not really, this is the only way to do it. There are more sensitive and there are better ways of approaching sources, but at the moment, it's a very difficult situation. Obviously, this kind of reaction is not good. Like I said before, I'm not saying don't contact sources, but it needs to be thought about very carefully how and when that happens. With another one, more abuse, hooray. Look in the mirror, be ashamed, then be more ashamed. You couldn't just wait a little while longer. That is an active situation. The shooter hadn't been found. It was still an ongoing situation. As the fifth one down, fuck off, someone's in goddamn danger, is both representative of the kind of anger and the feedback in these situations, but also a really important point. In this kind of situation, we don't know where the shooter is. We don't know if this person who originally tweeted is hiding or was safe when they tweeted and is now ducked behind a desk somewhere, and whether being distracted by bing, bing, bing could either mean that it puts her in danger or alerts the shooter. And we've seen, as in the case last summer with the journalists who were shot live on live TV, that the shooter in that situation tracked, he was tweeting as he was getting away from the police. And in these kind of active shooter situations and in other cases, the perpetrators are following the events on social media. And in many cases, eyewitnesses, if they tweet out a photo, may be advertising their position in an ongoing situation. And again, I'm not saying don't do this, don't get in touch, but it needs to be thought about much more seriously, and the kind of planning that both Sky and Storyful and a lot of other organizations put in place, there needs to be more preparation than just going, hi, I'm with X News, are you safe? Can I call you? When there's an ongoing shooter situation. She didn't get back to any of these people. She didn't get back to any of the pros. She replied a few hours later saying, I'm okay. Physically, we're being bussed off campus. Thank you to friends and strangers who got in touch. If you're looking for a story, I am not interested. I wonder why. This was a kind of even more succinct example from a couple of years ago when someone tweeted, I was just sitting in my room, my academic building, room 163, when I heard gunshots, rapid shots in the hallway. Hi, do you have any pictures of what's going on at the school to share? No, because I didn't think to take pictures while I thought my life was in jeopardy. Fair enough, I would think. This, in terms of protecting eyewitnesses and thinking of their safety and the situation that they're in, and especially about crediting, again, this has been touched on already, but this was a case from last year, which you may recognise, at the Shoreham Air Show, when a jet did not successfully complete a manoeuvre and crashed straight into a busy country road, A road, on a Saturday afternoon. It was chaos. I don't know if anyone saw this video, but it was flattened lampposts, flattened cars on fire, people inside cars on fire, and this guy who was at the scene, similar to all the other cases that we've talked about, started to shoot a video. He was, as I don't know if anyone else has been in a situation like this, but I can imagine it being very difficult to process. His reaction in the shock and his inability, struggle to figure out what was going on in front of him, he laughed, simply out of, what the fuck is going on? And this video was picked up by a viral news agency licensed to a lot of news organizations who included his name and some social media contacts details. And he got all kinds of abuse on YouTube and on Twitter for laughing from members of the public who weren't appreciative of what he was going through and his inability to process it and the shock that he was in. And that's a responsibility and a recognition there should be by news organisations of the amplification that they can give to eyewitnesses and also the risks and repercussions that can come by identifying them on such an enormous platform. I realise that I'm probably running out of time, so I'm going to skip through these last bits, but that's very important about appropriate crediting, but also brings us to the fact that videos like that are filmed at the scene many times in breaking news situations, but a lot of the time journalists are the filters to not the most gruesome, the most horrendous videos and pictures reaching the public audience. Journalists have to filter that, and some recent research from Eyewitness Media Hub found that more than nearly two-thirds of journalists view traumatic, graphic images on a weekly basis. It's slightly higher for human rights workers. And in a lot of ways, this is such a new phenomenon that people that many structures and organisations aren't set up to be able to manage it well. Some more testimony from the research was that someone saw a PTSD specialist. It's really expensive. It's not just about the work stuff. It's how it affects your life, not just your work, but your actual life. Someone else says, I can't leave my work at home. It's impossible. I'd love to talk about this. But people don't really want to talk about, for example, genocide down the pub. I feel isolated because people can't relate to my work. And one of the major factors in terms of how people deal with having to review some really horrendous things is with social support, both at work and with their friends and being able to talk about it. They also looked at what the most importance and usefulness of resources. One of them is to take regular breaks from work, have access to relevant training, positive reinforcement that you are doing this job and viewing this horrendous material for a reason, the mission of journalism, the mission of human rights workers, and that there is a reason for it. But in a lot of cases, those most important, and peer support networks, the social element that I talked about, in a lot of cases, those specific most important factors and useful in their usefulness in helping people get through it aren't being provided in those organizations. So it's really important this is changing and this is an ongoing situation, and hopefully kind of teeing up all of these things to the discussion in a minute. But with vicarious trauma, it's very important to have a self-care plan before going into a situation where you know you're going to have to review it, putting up that kind of mental armor, as Gavin Rees, who works at the Dart Center that specializes in this, says a lot. Not surprising colleagues saying, look at this is really important, and putting up something awful. Because if you want to work well as a team, you want to look after each other's and your own mental health as well as your physical health. There are lots of resources on all of these kind of things. Eyewitness Media Hub have got some guiding principles for handling eyewitness media across all of these points. Considering the physical and emotional welfare of an eyewitness, being transparent when content might be used, considering the intent of the eyewitness when they shared it, There's obviously a few more there. The ONA, a couple of weeks ago, published their social news gathering ethics code, which has, across the board, from how people find this information to verifying it and being transparent, exactly as Liza was saying, with the audience about the verification status of UGC, considering the emotional state and safety of contributors. It's just a 10-point list. And then the Dart Centre have also got six practical things media workers can do to reduce the trauma load in understanding what you're dealing with, eliminating needless repeat exposure, experimenting with different ways of building the distance into that, taking breaks, having a self-care plan. You can get all of those at the different Bitly links if it's of interest. And it's also something that we cover at First Draft News if you want to find out more there. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm sure that after all of that, there's probably quite a lot of questions from the audience. So rather than me taking over and asking lots of questions myself, could I see hands come up and then the microphone will come to you? If anybody's got any, there's... Thank you.
Hello, I'm Anne, a Finnish journalist, and I have a couple of questions. So for about the Sky News, so are you paying for these people for their footage? And then to Alastair about that, what then would be recommended ways to contact these eyewitnesses if those were like bad examples?
Okay, Abby, to take the first question. Thanks, Anne. It's a good question. Generally, we find with cases of really horrible events, atrocities, people don't want payment for their video. That's a generalisation, but I'd say in 80% of the cases, they really don't want money for it. So we wouldn't go in with an opening question of, oh, you know, we'll give you this much, can we have your video? It's always a question of asking whether we can use it, and if we're asked for money, then we'll reconsider. So we have paid for some videos, but usually in these kind of cases, the crisis... not so. And we also subscribe to Storyful because they provide verified eyewitness media as well. So in a sense, we're paying because we're using Storyful as well as doing our own journalism. But mostly no. It's slightly different when it's kind of lighter stories, viral videos. They tend to kind of have more of a monetary value attached to them, and people seek cash for those.
Do you want to pick up the...
Sure. In terms of like alternative ways to contact people, I think the message is not necessarily don't. If someone tweets... I'm in this situation, and it's in a newsworthy situation. I don't think the message is don't contact them. It's consider each case and each eyewitness as an individual source on their own merits, not just fire off a, hi, I'm from X, can I use your photo? In some cases, they might be, if they're responding, look at the social history, if they're responding to other people, as happens often, people like the first example that I used, he was initially talking to people. Look through the social history if they've given other ways to contact them. In some cases, people give out their phone number or their email address. But it's not just it's more not just being like, can I use your photo? It's thinking about each eyewitness as a source in the same way that they would be treated offline with the same kind of respect and sympathy, and figuring out what the best response and way to contact that person is in that situation rather than just the blanket approach.
I think I'd also add to that, what I do find looking at journalists approaching, nobody seems to check the timeline to go back to see the next tweet. So they see the tweet and they approach the eyewitness, but they haven't looked where the journalist has said, this isn't my picture. So one of the Brussels videos definitely wasn't, and they clearly said in Dutch, but that's easy enough to translate, or in Flemish, this isn't mine. But nobody bothers that, so they just keep bombarding. So I'll definitely add that one into it. Is there anything else that you guys wanted to... contribute before I open up again to...
I guess I would just say that you will have seen that one of those videos was licensed by Storyful, and we do go into licensing agreements with uploaders and eyewitnesses, and that's a 60-40 shared revenue, so 60% of all revenue made off of that video, whether it's sold to a news agency or it's ad revenue against a YouTube video, goes back to the uploader. And that way, we serve as kind of an intermediary. So any requests that they might have for their video then can be routed through us. So they don't actually have to deal with this barrage of requests. We can represent them in that. So I think that is helpful. Yes, as Hazel said, I think generally, you know, people in those scenarios, they don't want to make money off of a horrific event.
Great. There's a question down here at the front.
Hi, Tom from the BBC. Mark Zuckerberg said that everybody only has one identity. Do you think a world where everyone's identity was known would provide you with better UGC content because the person was verifiable, or worse because there'd be no anonymous sharing?
Anybody?
I think we've all got some thoughts on that. I don't know.
I can imagine.
That's a tough one. There are times when, like, identifying people, especially in some parts of the world, who, and this applies to human rights as well as journalism, who are reporting on a certain situation, or identifying them would put them in extreme danger. And that is why people, in many situations, take their conversations with journalists to closed networks and encrypted networks and encrypted and PGP email and all of that. Whether one is better than the other, I don't necessarily think there's... It's more about the... Again, it's the kind of the same point I made before in my perspective about treating each person as an individual source and whether they should be identified in that case, where journalists and news organisations are much more aware about the power that they have to amplify someone's... their name and have them potentially forever attached to a news story. And there's loads of research by Eyewitness Media Hub when they... People have a business which their name is associated to, but whenever someone Googles their name or their business, then it comes up with a news story, and they are forever associated with that, and that's not what they wanted.
Yeah. Leading on from that point, I think there are certain individuals who definitely want a level of privacy. So sometimes the social media accounts may be in a name that's not, you know, their legal name, etc. And I think sometimes when you come across people like that on social, it's easy to disregard them. Oh, that doesn't look like a real account. But I've certainly had examples where I've managed to get in direct contact with that person and actually have a conversation on the phone. And even the most dubious-looking accounts, it turns out to be a completely legitimate person behind them who simply values their privacy and doesn't want their actual name out there. And as long as I can speak to them and ask questions and try and put the pieces together, and I'm happy that I'm speaking to a real person who's witnessed what they claim to, then I don't mind if they're using some kind of oblique avatar.
Yeah, I don't think I can answer your question definitively either. But what I will say is that it's becoming increasingly difficult for us in social journalism to find original sources as people move to private messaging platforms. And BBC has done an excellent job in cultivating these communities, specifically on WhatsApp, to try and engage with these sources. But it's like any reporting that you will have done, you can't just kind of parachute into a scenario and expect people will communicate with you. And I think it is so important that we respect people's wish to remain anonymous. And there are so many stories we wouldn't have gotten at Storyful if we didn't respect that. There was one recently, the siege on Madaya in Syria, and a doctor was sharing really dramatic and graphic videos of Syrian children who were suffering starvation, but he didn't want to be identified for fear of reprisal. So if we hadn't been able to communicate with him on social from kind of a private account, and we didn't credit him, we credited the videos as anonymous, if we couldn't have that engagement on social, then we wouldn't get the access to that kind of content. So I think it's a case by case.
There was a question halfway down on the... Yeah. Thank you.
I once found myself in a situation, ongoing situation, where I forcibly had to stop people tweeting and make them switch off their phones. Consequently, I was almost charged for the use of force.
Almost charged for what, sorry?
For the use of force. But the police said there was no case.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, fortunate, or should that situation be repeated with somebody else? What might happen?
well, you know, there are cases of people who make their accounts private, either during a breaking news situation or afterwards because of the amount of requests and responses they receive. But the situation as it is at the moment is that people are essentially kind of crossing, as this phrase used recently, but crossing the police line in a breaking news situation, but doing it digitally. So whether the kind of actions that eyewitnesses may take in the future and in that situation may potentially mean that journalists and news organisations are less able to find the information that they need. I don't know if anyone's got...
Well, certainly in the aftermath of the attacks in Paris, the police asked people not to put any details on social media of raids that were taking place, and I think that was widely obeyed. And that kind of request that comes from an official source, a police source or otherwise, would be taken very seriously by certainly my organisation and I think many others. But you're right, in an ongoing situation where there's no chance for an official to make that kind of plea to news organisations, it is up to us to take some degree of responsibility. And one thing I think carefully about is making sure to ask somebody who I think is in the situation to produce more material, because I think at that point you are encouraging them. If they're doing it and they've done it already, there's nothing we can do, it's out there. But there's a very fine line between showing willingness to engage with that person and actually sort of appearing that you want more from them.
There's a question up the back, the chap with the hat on in the corner. So we get there in the end.
Is Storyful hiring?
We are actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, can I come speak to you after?
You can talk to me after.
Huh?
You can talk to me after.
All right, yeah. Last one.
I think unless there's any... question at the back. Yeah. Sorry, I was going to just get them all to round up with some tips of what everybody would be... handy tips.
How do you deal with the tension of journalistic scoop and cold hard cash, as in more clicks equals better for you all because of the advertisers?
What, in terms of verification, or in what, on what grounds?
Well, do you mean...
It's certainly quite difficult to get a scoop if something's already out on social media. That's something we've found. I think in the cases where you think there's a genuine scoop to be had, it's usually with the eyewitness that you found on the ground, i.e. sending our own team in, doing some negotiation with them on the spot, which makes it a lot easier to verify because they're actually there and they can show them, they can explain what they saw and show any other further material they might have filmed or captured. And that's when we might consider an exclusive. I think it's extremely difficult to try and claim an exclusive for something that's already out on the social web.
And in terms of verification, I mean, everything should be verified, because if you get it wrong, we can reel off the number of stories recently in the last 6 months which have involved faked or misappropriated supposedly eyewitness footage. As Eliza was talking about the CCTV videos, there was a case in January of a flight that was redirected because of turbulence, where a video that was used as the basis of an entire story was actually 3 years old. And this happens all the time in terms of people sharing things. We haven't talked about that much yet, but in terms of the people sharing things in a breaking news situation or relevant to a story, which are not relevant to that story. It's often old. But it gets picked up by news organizations. And yes, they probably do get the clicks out of it. And then they pull the article, and some of them even might then write a debunk later to catch both waves. But everyone can see that. The audience can see that and knows when they're getting lied to. I was going to say shafted, but lied to is probably better. When people aren't being true. And it's the same as with individuals. Like, if I met someone who was wrong about something and then completely denied it later, I would have a different view about them. It's the same in news organisations.
A question down at the front.
Yeah, just I trained as a journalist about 20 years ago, and since then been doing some freelance. So a lot has changed in journalism since then, obviously. So the question is the legal implications and protection for yourselves and for as agencies, and also for journalists going out to report, say, for instance, scene of a crime, witnesses, you can't, divulge certain names, especially if it's taken to court, or if it's in the courts, European courts, or if it's in the courts of the UK and things. What are the legal implications for both sides of the story, please?
Did you? No.
Certainly for the majority of the cases that we deal with, the legal implications are exactly the same for any other story that we'd cover. So things like revealing names of witnesses. I mean, journalists have been interviewing eyewitnesses since the beginning of journalism. So there's nothing there that's different. The main thing that comes onto our plate as social media news gatherers is questions of copyright, and that's a big, complex area. There's a lot of grey areas, and there's not many test cases to refer to, which is what makes it so difficult.
Yeah, I would echo everything Hazel said, but I would also add there's this extra layer now with social media content where if you have an original video or photo, there's a huge amount of data attached to that. So let's say this person wants to remain anonymous, but you've shared the video or photo on the platform with that EXIF data attached to it. If someone wanted to know more about that person, they could instantly figure out where they were, who they were, when they took the photo, what sort of camera they took it with. So from a legal standpoint, that's something we're conscious of as well.
There's one more against the wall over there, and then I think I'm aware that we're standing between you and a cup of tea or whatever it is.
Thank you. This may be a naive question, but is it easier once a video is verified that it is the time and date and the place that it says to actually use it if it isn't from the UK, from Europe, and from the Americas?
The only barrier that I've seen for that is if it's been licensed with an agency specifically for like the British territory. And that's the only obstacle that I've seen, but we do global coverage, so every day I'm engaging with people from across the globe, from Syria to Ecuador to the US. So I think licensing barriers would be the main. Right. Our company was really founded on the principle of, you know, protecting eyewitnesses and giving them compensation for their content. So we're always thinking about that no matter what. I think in terms of the global reach that you're referring to, I think we're getting to stories that we ordinarily or wouldn't have before social. So especially in Syria, you know, we have no access. So we have a huge number of activist sources that we're in communication with daily. But again, like, we are very conscious of the obstacles and the challenges that they're facing day to day. So I think in many ways it's really opened our eyes to different types of stories. I think the other edge of that is really being aware, you know, not every story touches social media for connectivity reasons, for, you know, access to internet, even if there is connectivity, you know, different levels of society may not have access. So you want to be conscious and cognizant of that. What stories might you be missing only looking on social?
I'd just like to ask the panel just to give a few takeaway tips. I know there's a lot of students here or working journalists, but just to give you something to take away to think about of what you need to be doing to verify stuff. Just a very short little summary.
Yep, certainly my top tip is try to speak to a native speaker of the language spoken by people who may have witnessed the event. Certainly I've been caught out with this. I thought my French was all right, but it's not great. And from the Paris attacks, I looked for content tagged Bataclan and entirely overlooked everything tagged Le Bataclan. It's obvious to anyone who's a native speaker of French that the definite article might have been used there wasn't to me.
Yeah, local languages is a really good one. I would also say just all of the things, if you're a student, the things you're learning in your classes for print reporting, it's the same application. So, like, I that's how I approach all of the verification work that I do. I'm doing research, I'm doing reporting, I'm trying to call someone. I think the same principles apply. I think maybe those are the challenges we have in trying to enforce some of these things. Maybe people think in sourcing social content those things don't apply, but they do.
I would say in terms of like